The subject matter in this episode may not be suitable for young listeners, so please be advised and use your discretion accordingly.
Being a ministry wife is a vocation without a job description. And let's be honest, sometimes it seems like ministry might be easier if we did have one. If you are a ministry wife like me and are looking for hope, perspective, and a little bit of practical advice regarding your role, you're in the right place. Hi, I'm Christine Hoover, author of How to Thrive as a Pastor's Wife. Welcome to the Ministry Wives Podcast, a production of the North American Mission Board. Join me as we hear from women from various ministry contexts, having authentic conversations about our shared joys and challenges, even the ones we're unsure we can talk about. No topic is off limits. Today, my guest is Cassie Hammett. Cassie is the founder of The Hub Urban Ministries in Shreveport, Louisiana. In our conversation today, she shares about her work with The Hub and its two main ministries, one serving the homeless and the other serving trafficked women and children. I asked Cassie to speak to us as women who long to serve not just our church, but our communities. She shares about her first timid and uninformed steps into serving the homeless, and she also shares about how she's persevered in such a difficult service oriented ministry for so many years. You will definitely be encouraged and helped by Cassie's story and her insights about how we too can serve people around us. So here, friends, is my conversation with Cassie Hammett. I'm really excited to get to welcome Cassie Hammett to the podcast. Welcome, Cassie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Tell me where you're talking to me from.
I am in Shreveport, Louisiana. It's the top left corner of the state.
I know where it is because I grew up in East Texas. We used to go through I-20.
Yes.
What'd you say?
We're basically East Texas. We have to claim it, not Louisiana.
That's not true. I mean, Shreveport has, it's got Louisiana. We used to go on I-20 going east. We would always stop in Shreveport for Cajun food.
Yes, the best. The best.
Yes,
food.
Yes. Yeah. Have you lived there your whole life? Are you from Louisiana?
Yes, I was born and raised here.
Okay. That's amazing. So tell us about your family and we'll get to what you're doing, but I want to hear first about your family.
Yeah. So I am married to Brent Hammett. We've been married almost 17 years and we have two daughters. One is 11 years old. Her name is Liv. And the youngest one is 8 and her name is Esther. They're both internationally adopted. Liv is from the Congo and Esther is from Guangzhou, China. So they both joined our family. Liv joined our family about 10 years ago. And then Esther joined 5 years ago recently. So so the four of us, we all live in Shreveport. That's duh. My husband was born and raised in Louisiana, and he is a graphic designer, freelance, runs his own creative company. And my kids are in school and doing amazing. And we travel as a family to do ministry across the country, which we're super thankful to be able to do that together. We travel between all of our models that we're developing with Send Relief. And so, so we're kind of a gypsy family.
So. That's amazing. Okay. Let's talk about what you do because you do amazing work there in Shreveport, but it's expanding beyond Shreveport. So tell us about your ministry that you've founded.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I'm the founder executive director of a ministry in Shreveport called The Hub Urban Ministries. This is our 16th year of ministry. So if you're doing the math, started that ministry less than a year after I got married, which is a little bit of a wild ride, for the first part of a marriage. Also, I was very young when I started The Hub. And it's funny because often people are like, how did you start The Hub? And my most honest answer is accidentally. it was not necessarily on my radar. I didn't go to school to run a nonprofit or to start a nonprofit. Definitely did not know that that's what the Lord saw fit for not just our family, but for our city. So it was not accidental, obviously, in God's plan for what he saw fit for our city, but it was accidental for me. I like to say that because I think people think like, oh, you must have had all the knowledge and, you know, started with, you know, everything you needed to know and a plan and all of those things. And I'm like, no, actually, I didn't. I really, honestly, all of, if I can backtrack when the hub, quote unquote, started, I didn't know that's what it was going to be, but was just hanging out with those experiencing homelessness in my city and feeding people out of the trunk of my car. I didn't know, you know, that that was the beginning of what is now a 16-year-old thriving ministry. So we have two primary ministries that we do. One is called the Lovewell Center, and that is a resource center for those experiencing material poverty and homelessness. And we serve people there through a model that has three kind of main components. It's a membership-based model, which essentially means everyone who comes in gets the opportunity to become a member. And that's a big part of our model, and I'm going to explain that in a second. We also have schedules of classes and opportunities and things going on where those members can then earn credits on their membership account by attending those classes and programs. And then they can spend those credits in our stores that are located inside of our building. And so technically nothing in our resource stores is free. Because what we're trying to allow for people to experience is the dignity of empowerment, the dignity of earning and investing in their own life, and also leaving with resources that they did something to produce. And so the membership piece of it is about belonging. You know, for those people listening, we're probably members of a dozen things in our life, whether it's a gym or Costco or, you know, a church, you know, we're members all over the place. And I think we do take that for granted often. But when you think about being a member somewhere, you belong there. You're not just tolerated. You're expected. And also you have a voice, and you have, to some degree, depending on the membership, you don't really have a voice at Costco, but you know what I mean?
Right.
you at least have some buy-in there. And so, you know, we believe at the Hub that all people were created in God's image, and that life circumstances can pile up on top of someone's life, right? But it does not change the very root truth that they were created in God's image. And that that originating purpose is still there. And we just believe that it's our job as a ministry to walk alongside of people and help uncover that original design. And what we know to be true is that for every person that God created, that He created us with the desire to tend to things and to work. And, you know, oftentimes people think of work as, you know, after the fall, you know, after sin, but in reality it wasn't. It was a part of God's really good plan for people. And so the Lovewell Center model basically just unpacks what does it look like to empower people and remind them that they can actually show up for their life and show up and engage in that life changing, and also come alongside and meet their very real emergency physical needs, because those in material poverty do have really large deficits in their life that we want to be a part of meeting, but we want to do it in a way that is dignifying and healthy and sustainable for them long term. So that's what we're doing at the Lovewell Center every day. We've been open there for 10 years. That facility has been open for 10 years, and we have around 6,000 members. And so it's definitely a model that people respond to. And I always joke and sort of pray that all 6,000 never show up at the same time, because that would be fire marshal would not be happy about that. But yeah, so we're just, our team is just doing that work every day. We're open during the week, and really obviously a safe place for people to belong. First of all, you don't have to be a member to come into the facility or to spend time in the community room or use the internet or eat the food and stuff like that. You don't have to be a member, but if you want to engage in those resource stores, which we have a clothing store called the Dress Well, a food store called the Eat Well, and then a laundromat called the Smell Well. And those are the things that the model sort of, that's the friction, is you can come in and spend time. You belong here. We want you here. But if you want to engage in those deeper resources, then that's sort of where the push pull of empowerment comes in. And I think people think surely people don't respond well to that, but it's just not true. It's not the case. I mean, there are people who, I mean, they could go other places in our city to get access to the same resources, but they don't, because there is something to feeling. It's just a different process for people to show up and go to a class that's helping them advance and move. You know, all of our class, they're not busy work. They're designed around the research that goes behind poverty alleviation and what does it look like to actually alleviate poverty. So those classes are very intentional, and so people can engage in those throughout the week. So that's one part of our ministry that we're doing at the Lovewell Center. On the other end of our ministry is Purchased, Not For Sale, which is a ministry to women and children experiencing sexual exploitation and victims of sex trafficking, both adults and children. And so some of the same premises, some of the, as the Lovewell Center, same sort of heart and model behind empowerment and a dignifying approach to recovery for victims of exploitation. Differences being on the Purchase side, we do have a housing, a residential program. It's 9 to 12 months. We have a diversion program with our DA's offices, and we have a juvenile program for children who are highest risk to being trafficked. And so that ministry is really about being, again, a place of belonging for a group of people that are probably considered the most at risk in our community and definitely considered the most outcasted of our, you know, you have, people are accustomed to homelessness and poverty, but I think when you're dealing with women who are experiencing homelessness, poverty, and prostitution, you really get into some territory where they're very niched off in society. And so, so we're running those programs and seeing, obviously, God do what only He can do to restore some of the most broken lives I've ever encountered. And we're just really thankful to be on the front lines in our community doing that work. We are considered like first responders in our community when it comes to trafficking. And so when there's a victim, law enforcement or any community agency, we're typically the first call. We also run the community hotline. So all reporting. So all reporting goes through our ministry as well. And a lot of that comes from just the length of time we've been here, but also we're the only anti-trafficking organization in the region. And so we kind of fill the void in those ways. And so, so we're just coming alongside of the women and children that we're serving and doing our very best to, in a trauma-informed, biblically-based way, give them access to full restoration. The Hub's mission statement is the Hub is on a mission to give everyone in our city access to a restored life. And we do that through those two main ministries that I just described. And then the last thing I would say is we just started about a year and a half ago, a social enterprise called Rise Up and Roast. So if anyone listening likes coffee, I'm going to do a shameless plug.
Do it.
We have a coffee company that employs out of the programs that I just described, and basically is a coffee distributor to, right now we have a little over 30 wholesale accounts, and we also have an online retail business. And our employees come through the programs of the Hub, and it's sort of the final piece of their programming, which is to move into a job readiness portion and apply what they're learning in the business of Rise Up and Roast. And then they go on from us to full-time employment in the community. And so that's kind of, that's a lot of information, but that's the model of the Hub. And we accomplish all of those things, all of it, through volunteers primarily. And I would say most of our volunteers come through partnership with the local church here in our community. So it's That's a really amazing. Beautiful expression. It's a really beautiful expression of what it looks like for churches to just come together and not do for their, you know, with their name on anything, but to come together to serve the most vulnerable. And that's sort of been the model of the Hub since we started, is not to do the work of the church for the church, but to be sort of the bridge between the most vulnerable and the church, and be the equipping, sort of coming alongside of churches, teaching them how to serve these populations. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we've been doing for the last 16 years. And then I would say probably about 6 or 7 years ago, we started duplicating in other places. And so now we have 7 different locations outside of Shreveport. A few of
those.
Where
are those? Yeah, tell us, because if people are listening and want to get involved.
Yeah, totally. So I also work for Send Relief. If people aren't familiar, it's a part of the North American Mission Board. And so a few of those locations are actually Send Relief Ministry Centers. So we have the hub in Las Vegas. That's a Send Relief affiliate. We also have a brand new location starting in Denver that is through the Send Relief team there. And then we have the one in here in Shreveport. We have a location in Lafayette, Louisiana, which is just south of us. We have a location in Fort Worth, Texas, a location in Northeast Louisiana, in the Ruston, West Monroe area. And then we have a location in Macomb, Mississippi, of all places.
Okay. That's awesome.
A little bit off the beaten path. Yeah. Yeah. So, we started doing the work of duplication around 6 or 7 years ago. So that kind of sums up, you know, the most important things of what we're doing here at the hub and what we've been doing.
Thank you. I want to go back to that moment where you said, I started with the out of the trunk of my car and I'm just feeding people, because what you just described is an amazing, first of all, a lot of hard work for 16 years and the Lord really helping grow that and cultivate that. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking of, I wanted to talk to you because I'm thinking of the pastor's wives listening who are like, I want to be a blessing to my community, but I have no idea where to start. And so I'd love to go back and just in your story first to hear, how did God lead you to this kind of work where you're opening the trunk of your car and passing out food, especially in the town you grew up in? I think sometimes when we grow up in a place, we start to lose, we don't see people anymore. Yeah. And so how did that begin for you?
Yeah. So I would say, not to take it back to when I was born, but I do think I have always had a little bit of a justice meter that just sort of was built into the wiring of who I've always been. Mm-hmm. But I will say that when I try to encourage people, because I can imagine listening, it is hard to listen to someone that's 16 years down the road and to be like, oh no, you know, I need to be doing X, Y, Z, or I'm not doing enough. And again, I often remind people, hey, this 16 years is a really long time, first of all, but that for me, the first thing that happened in my life was that the Lord had to radically change me. This wasn't a, sort of legalistic approach to, oh no, I'm supposed to be serving the poor, so I need to get out there and do it. This came from a transformed heart. Like God had to sort of wreck me first, had to intersect my life and transform the parts of my heart that were maybe tilted towards not focusing on those in my city that were suffering. And he did, it's a longer story, but he did that through several different things. But I do believe that was key in my, and that is key in my story, because I think what has allowed for me to stay in the work as long as I have is that this all didn't start with a good idea. This started because I encountered Jesus in a way that radically changed me. And so at the end of the day, that's still the case, is that he had to sort of open my eyes first. And so when I say at the beginning of the hub, again, I didn't know that's what it was, but I was just trying my hardest to be obedient to what I believed the Lord was asking of me. I was not thinking about starting anything or involving anyone else, or except for my husband, but he was, you know, voluntold, you know, still is, honestly. But it wasn't about anything else except for I now had this new understanding of the gospel and this new understanding of a lot of scripture and this new understanding of like my responsibility, honestly. And so the beginnings really was me just trying to walk that out in the best way that I knew how, which was really uninformed. I mean, I wasn't raised in poverty. Thankfully, I was raised by parents that exposed us to that. And I had a very diverse upbringing and things like that, which is not the case for a lot of people where I live. But the part of my story that I love the most is that the Lord knew that it had to start with me first if I was going to ask anyone to do it, for it to be authentic and for it to be sustainable and long lasting. Because once and so the second thing I would tell people listening is that the fuel of everything that I just talked about is friendship. It started with that. You know, when you are friends with someone, you will do anything to help them. I mean, that if we view those in poverty through the lens of saying they're just individuals in poverty, that's one approach. But if we know their names, their stories, and they're our friends, that is a completely different ballgame. And what I try to encourage people with is that you do not have to start anything to be someone's friend. You do not have to start an organization. You don't have to start a platform, a ministry. You don't have to do any of those things to show up in people's lives and just be their friends. And that honestly was the, now I can look back and see, but that was the absolute foundation of success for the Hub when it comes to the populations we're serving, is the amount of years spent just being their friend. Because then when we started responding, which is what you just heard, you hear this big model, right? You hear all of these pieces. Well, really what you're hearing was built out of a response to our friends. So we didn't go to them with the idea. Like, we didn't go to them and say, hey, we built this whole thing and we think it's going to help you. They came to us, and through those friendships, we then turned around and built something that reflected what they actually needed. And that's still the case. That's still something that we're doing all the time. It's just listening and just being friends with those that we're serving to the best of our ability. And that's what radically changed me. That's what really started the Hub almost overnight. It was a massive success almost overnight. But I think it's because people had never been given the opportunity to know how to do that. It wasn't that people didn't want to. The church wasn't just turning a blind eye in my community and saying, we don't want to be a part. It was just, what do? We don't know how to start. And I think we just met that need for people to say, hey, it's as simple as this guy's name is Joe and he lives under this bridge and this is what just happened to him. And we think that you can step in, provide physically, but we also want you to come meet him. And we don't want you to give us the stuff you've collected and us give it to him. We want you to do it. We want you to bring your small group and we want you to meet him because you collected the stuff, not us. And that's how organically it started, is people would go under this bridge and take this stuff and meet Joe, and they would come out completely changed forever. And then they would say, okay, now what do we do? You know, what do we do next? And just pointing people back to say, just keep caring for him. You know where he lives now, you know his, you know, needs and what he's going through. And I think people were really, it was a really refreshing thing for people to be pushed out of their comfort zone to that degree. Cause it's a lot easier to collect sleeping bags and drop them off at a nonprofit than it is to take it
to go
under the bridge.
but take me back, Cassie, because before you could get a small group to go, you went. So you,
totally.
You were the person, I would imagine you going by yourself even, or maybe your husband was with you, but like that moment where you step out of your car and there's this person under the bridge, like that's the part that we imagine and go, I can't do that. You know, just the beginning, the initial. So how did you talk yourself? Like, what was the Lord saying to you? And what were you telling yourself? Because I think that's the hardest part, is just the first step.
So again, very uninformed back then. I had no idea what I was doing. So a lot of it, I didn't do great early on. A lot of it, I failed in those first, you know, encounters. I went into them with a lot of you know, assumptions, or I went into them with an agenda and learned the very hard way. Because, you know, when you do, when you approach people that are suffering to the degree that our friends are, they don't mind telling you when you're missing it.
Okay. Sometimes, there you go.
Sometimes not in the nicest ways. But I think what I would say now, being more informed now, what I know is that I think what keeps people from engaging with individuals in different socioeconomic, you know, levels.
Yeah.
Is that there's an assumption that, oh my gosh, we're so different. There's this chasm between me and her. There's this chasm between me and him.
That's right.
I also think we bring a lot of assumptions. We think, well, he's in this situation because he probably did X, Y, Z, or he probably has a mental illness, or, you know, we have all of these predetermined ideas that I do think create a lot of fear to think there's too big of a chasm here.
But
the actual truth is that there isn't that big of a chasm. Most of the time, the difference is just material. And now you do get into some extremes of like mental illness and mental health and all of those things. But at the end of the day, really what separates most of the time is just material possessions. And once you wrap your head around the fact that material possessions do not equal poverty, meaning that poverty is way more than that. It's not just about material possessions. Then you realize, man, poverty is a relational thing. It's an emotional thing. It's a need-based thing. And all of us have those things in common. You start to realize that you're actually not that different. And I think that that sort of diffuses some of that fear, you know? Now there's nothing that's going to change those first interactions being awkward, but so what? That's what I always say. Like, okay, so they're awkward, right? Like, so they may be a little risky for you socially. You may feel uncomfortable, but like, it's worth us experiencing those things so that someone who maybe has gone the whole day feeling unseen and unknown and looked over doesn't feel that way. So what if it's awkward, right? Like, we can shake that off. So what if we're uncomfortable for a few seconds or a few minutes? And so what if it doesn't go well? Like, sometimes even someone who's done this work for 16 years, sometimes when I approach someone, it doesn't go well. But what I do know is that that person knows that I tried. There's an example of this. On my drive home at this point in Shreveport, I'm like a celebrity in all the places your mama tells you not to go. So, it's very rare that I encounter someone that doesn't at least has not at least heard of the Hub or heard of the Lovewell when it comes to those living in poverty and homelessness. So, but, on my drive home, there's a friend that sits at a bus stop, and he's a homeless friend. And, I've tried to interact with him a few times and it did not go well. And my kids have always been in the car because it's always on our drive home. And it bothers my kids that it doesn't. It's been this whole saga. Like, he doesn't want to be our friends and he yells at us and all these things. And so I told my girls a few weeks ago, I was like, well, what we're going to do is our new approach is that when we stop at this red light, because he's there every day, all we're going to do is smile really big and we're just going to wave at him. That's it. That's all we're going to do. And so that's what we've been doing for a few weeks. And we've been doing that over and over. And people listening may be like, well, that doesn't do anything. But it does do something. Because what I've noticed now is he now knows my car. And when I pull up to the light, he is already waving. Which what that tells me is he now knows these people are coming to this light every day and they are waving at me. That matters if from sunup to sundown, no one has acknowledged you. It matters. It's a dignity thing. Maybe I'm not helping him get housing yet, keyword, because I will. But, you know, maybe that's not the case. And maybe I never will. Maybe it won't ever go past what it is now. But what I have to remember is that is not my job. It is God's job to do what only God can do. All I can do is what I can do, which is look him in the eyes, acknowledge him, wave, try to interact, and honestly wait on him to feel that he trusts me enough to interact. I do believe that'll happen. But I think that that's, I think sometimes we just put so much pressure on ourselves for these interactions to be like these one and done things where it's like we have this amazing conversation with someone and we share the gospel and they receive Jesus right under the bridge at the red light, you know, and we want, you know, we want it to be this and we fear that if it's not that, then it'll be a failure. And so we just don't do anything.
Yeah.
And what I always try to remind people is when you're at a red light and you're white knuckling your steering wheel and doing everything in your power to not look at someone, they can see that. And all you have to do is say hi. All you have to do is acknowledge and give them your name and ask them their name. Those are really simple things that a lot of times people don't know this, but because of the work that I do, I interact with people in homelessness all the time. And you'll hear them say things like, oh, I knew I could come here to the Love Well because, you know, Nathan on your team always passed me on the road and always waved at me. Or stuff like that. It matters. Like, it matters that we do anything when we're given the opportunity. We don't have to be skilled and know all the answers.
Yeah.
And so I would just encourage people. I mean, there are a few practical things I could encourage people with, but really just remembering that, like, at the end of the day, this is about relationship. And this is about long-term caring for people. And if you live in a community, you can do that. You can, it can be more than just a one and done sort of thing. It can be a long-term investment that you're making. And when it is, it takes the pressure off of those first interactions to think, oh, I have to fix everything in that moment. Because I don't even think that way. Like, even having access to the ministry that I do, I don't always think it's mine to do. Like, sometimes it's not. And so I would say, practically speaking, you know, having things in your, you know, if you live in a city where there's visible poverty and visible homelessness and you're looking for how do I get involved in this, I can give some practical steps.
Yes, please.
Which, one, I would say always have, just be ready. Have stuff in your car that you can easily reach behind and grab. A little bag you could put together with a granola bar, some food, a water bottle, and write down, even if it's just writing down a few local services to put in that bag. That way, when you do have those sort of like out of nowhere opportunities, you actually can do something. You can actually hand someone a physical thing that opens up a conversation. So always having a few of those on hand, especially if you live in a city where that's pretty normal. Because that lowers that fear of like, I don't know what to do, because then you do know what to do. Like, you have something.
Right.
Always including a list of resources, even if you just write it on a piece of paper and fold it into there. Like, hey, here's, you know, the top three places that can help you. That's one really practical thing. But another is to do the homework of the city that you live in and research who's already doing the work in those categories and finding a way to do that under the umbrella of their ministry. You know, there's people, I know without a doubt that there's people in cities all across America that people are listening. There are people who've been in the trenches for years and years and years who are looking for people to help. And so the easiest way to get started, even if someone feels like even if they feel personally that they're supposed to start something, I would still say start under someone else.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because you're going to learn so much under someone else's umbrella. But also, before starting anything, you need to learn how to be in the trenches with people. Don't start anything without knowing that, you know, counting the cost of like what it actually means. And I think that's a really easy practical step that is a little harder. It takes a little more effort than having a bag in your car to give away. It requires you give your time away volunteering, but you can learn so much from volunteering that will shape whatever it is that you feel called to do in the future. So I would just say those would be two really practical ways people could go from zero to taking, you know, the first three steps. And then honestly, after those first three steps, like the Lord makes clear the next ones. And you'll be so changed by those first three steps that like you're a different person going into the next ones anyways. So honestly, it's not worth planning out the next, you know, year right. of what you're going to do, because you're going to toss all of that in the trash once you actually have friendship with those that, you know, you're feeling called to serve.
That's,
so helpful. That would be some practical things.
Thank you. That's so helpful. I also would love to hear just your advice for discouragement, because if you've been doing this for 16 years and really you're on the front lines serving people as Jesus served us, you know, what I imagine as you're talking, I'm like thinking about reading, I've been reading John and watching Jesus, watching, like imagining him walking amongst people and healing them and seeing people who others aren't seeing or who are, have they've rejected. And so you're doing that. So what has Jesus taught you about, or how does he encourage you when you're discouraged and you're thinking, man, this is the long game. And sometimes I love you said very hopefully about this man that you're waving at. But when you get discouraged, how has God encouraged you to continue serving in this way?
So I think the biggest answer to that is learning my place in the equation. So there's a story in the New Testament about Jesus being, he's teaching and healing somewhere, and some friends hear about it and their paralyzed friend, and they want to get him to Jesus to be healed. And I love that story so much for so many reasons, but you know, this man can't get there on his own. And so his friends, you know, pick him up and carry him to the place where Jesus is. They get there. It's too crowded. We all know the story. They go to the roof, cut a hole, which I'm always like, you need to have friends like that in your life that would just be like, we can't get in. Well, it looks like we're going through the roof. Yeah. Definitely get you some friends that crazy. But they go to the roof and they lower him down and in front of Jesus. And there's this moment where we read over it really quickly. And I think we miss this one little piece. But in other stories where Jesus heals people, he says, you know, you're healed, your faith has healed you. Or he says, go and sin no more, your faith has healed you. But in this story, he doesn't say that. It says when he saw their faith, the faith of the friends, it says their faith moved him to heal this man. And I think that story gives us the definition of the role that we play. So we are not the healers. You know, that is reserved only for Jesus, only. And in that story, we find our role in the friends. You know, our job is to pick up people's mats and do our very best to get them to him. But the reality is that it's his to do. It's his to heal. So two things. It's his job to heal people. And it's the people in need of healing's responsibility to take ownership of that and to receive it. And we can't do either of those. We try to do both.
Yes.
We can't do either. And so for me, I have to remind myself consistently, I'm a mat carrier. That's not my job. If that person is not receiving help, that's not my job. Like I did the very best I could do. I physically got involved and did everything in my power to clear the path between them and restoration. And the rest is up to Jesus and them to receive it. And I think that alone allows for me to, I wouldn't say that I stay out of discouragement, because I think that that would be really inauthentic for me to say. I think it's important for people to know that, you know, in the work that we do, there's just no way around being discouraged. There's no way around it, because if your heart is fleshy, if Jesus has made that happen, it's not a heart of stone anymore, and you're looking at people who are refusing help or refusing, I mean, there is no way for that to not, I have people all the time be like, I don't know how you do what you do and it not faze you. I'm like, well, I don't know who told you that, because it does actually faze me. Like, it's not that it doesn't, but I think that when it does, I have to go back to the reality that, like, do I think, I have to double check with my own self. I have to say, do I think that it was my job? Like, am I acting in this situation as though it was my job to heal her or heal him or change what's going on inside of them? Because if that's the seat that I'm in, of course I'm going to feel discouraged. And I have to return back to the proper seat and say, hey, I did everything in my power, or I can continue to carry their mat. I can continue to pick them up. I can continue when they walk away from that opportunity and need it again down the road. I can continue to pick their mat up and clear that path, but it's not my job ultimately to change them or transform them. And I think it's such a relief, you know? So that's one thing. The other thing I would say, which this sounds a little possibly unrelated, is I am very committed to rest and Sabbath, very committed. And I think that those two things in my life allow for me to keep going forward when it really just feels like I want to throw in the towel. I think remembering the role that I play and then weekly remembering that I can unplug and everything will be fine, that I'm not that important. You know what I mean? Like, it does not all depend on me. That keeps me in check too. And so I'm very committed to a weekly, like a biblical Sabbath, one that, and I don't do that with 100% accuracy or, you know, consistency, but it is a priority for me and my family to practice a Sabbath. And I've noticed that combined with keeping a proper perspective on my role, I think those two things have allowed for me to stay in the game as long as I have, because I go into every new week with a fresh reminder that I'm not as important as I like to think that I am. And I think that that's important. I think we have to know that, you know, I think we have to know that it doesn't all revolve around us. And so, I don't know. I hope that answers that question.
Yes. And that is a great word to end on for everyone listening, no matter if they're doing we're all doing some sort of ministry. And what you just said has been key for me as well. And I've learned, it's taken me a long time to learn those things, but
me too.
And I'm still learning. But that's such a good word. And I'm so thankful for your ministry. I loved getting to hear about it today. I hope that this will spark some prayer for people listening about how can I get involved in these kinds of things in my community. Mm-hmm. And so thank you so much, Cassie, for being willing to join me and share your story.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
In our conversation, Cassie mentioned becoming educated about working with vulnerable populations. After we stopped recording, I asked her for helpful resources that she would recommend to us. She offered several books and podcasts, which I have linked for you in the show notes. Be sure and check those out. And while you're there, be sure to click on the link that allows you to share your funniest or most embarrassing moment in ministry. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening to the Ministry Wives podcast, a production of the North American Mission Board. If you found this content helpful, please rate and review us on your podcast platform or share it with a friend. You can find this podcast and other helpful resources at ministrywivespodcast.com.
So what we want to do today was have some follow-up questions from those things.
You know more about my life than I do right now, so it's all right.
Dr. Tony Evans is an internationally acclaimed preacher and author. Listen to his story from the very beginning, start to finish, the life and ministry of Dr. Tony Evans. Episodes drop soon. Subscribe wherever and however you listen.